I forgetting anything? Lindell, did I say I was going to introduce anything else? We got it all, right? Yeah. Okay. So I invited you to Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. I'd like to read starting at verse 18. And the writer of Romans, Apostle Paul, says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them." And here's the verse I'd like us to think about specifically. "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forevermore. Amen." I remember sitting in a doctor's office at my local doctor's office, and the television screen was on there in the office playing some show of some sort, and had a nature program on. It was talking about a plant or an animal that had adapted to its surroundings in some way, and the show glorified the creation instead of glorifying the Creator. It was an intelligent animal that somehow figured out how to adapt to its surrounding. And I just sat there and said, no, you're missing it entirely. That animal was made to do that. And this passage says that when people deny the Creator, they begin to give glory to the creation instead of to the one who has made it. Tonight, we'd like to look at one aspect of God's general revelation of himself, and that is what we can learn about him through the things he has made. Verse 20 here says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen." How do we understand it? By the things that are made. We can even understand his eternal power and his Godhead, it says, by looking at his creation. I tell my math students, I try to say it 10 times or 100 times every year, but when we study math, we are learning how to think God's thoughts after him. Because we've been able to study the created world, and we've been able to, using the minds that God has given us, we've been able to figure out how it works. And when we figure it out, we can just stand back in awe and say, wow, what an awesome world. Or we can stand back in awe and say, what a wonderful Creator. And so I hope that my students get the message that everything we're doing, even in math, is giving us a picture of who God is, and we can learn about his nature even from doing math. I've entitled this presentation, "The Miracles of Creation," and borrowing the title of a song, I think, by Gordon Moat, "Don't Let Me Miss the Glory." And if you could just bear with me, I thought I had this in presentation mode, and it's not opened in presentation mode. But maybe now that I'm hooked up to the projector, it will. I heard something shut off. My document did open in presentation mode the way I wanted it to, but when I switched it off, the disconnect maybe shut down the projector? I'm not sure. I think we're good. Okay. I have notes in there that I need. So, yes, I believe I mentioned Gordon Moat wrote a song entitled "Don't Let Me Miss the Glory." And I hope tonight that you don't walk away and miss the glory of God as revealed in His creation. It's a pretty full presentation, and so I am going to move quickly as we go. I like to use a song, another song, which I think was written by John Moore and sung by Steve Green, recorded years ago, called "God and God Alone," and an excerpt from that song at the top of the screen: "From the mighty to the small, the glory in them all is God's, and God's alone." The height of a tall person is about 2 meters. And if you take that height and multiply it by 10, you get the length of a common tractor trailer truck. If you take that length times 10, you get the height of an average skyscraper. If you take that times 10, you get the approximate length of the Golden Gate Bridge. And if you take that times 10, you get the distance across the city of San Francisco. And if you take that distance times 10, you have the distance across what would be known as the San Francisco Bay Area of California. If you take that distance times 10, we have the approximate distance across the southwest corner of the United States. And if you take that distance times 10, you get the approximate diameter of our Earth. If you take that distance times 10, you get the diameter of Jupiter, approximately. And if you take that distance times 10, you have the distance across our sun. If you take that distance times 100, you then have the approximate distance between the Earth and the sun, which we know to be about 93 million miles. And if you take that distance times 200,000, you have the approximate distance from Earth to the nearest star beyond the sun, Alpha Centauri, or 4+ light years away. We're not done yet. If you take that distance times 25,000, you then have the estimated distance across our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. How big is the universe? I'm lost by the time you get to that point of how far away we are. There's a photo of the Milky Way galaxy. On a very dark night and a clear night, sometimes you can see the haze of the Milky Way galaxy as you look out from Earth, from our vantage point, through the layer of stars. You might be able to see the white haze in the sky. It's kind of like a highway across the middle of the sky. Well, that's the glow of the Milky Way. Psalm 147:4 says, "He telleth the number of the stars." God knows how many stars there are. Not only that, He calleth them all by their names. So God has a name for every star. Well, how many stars are there in the universe? We can only estimate. So the way astronomers estimate this is by estimating how many stars are in a galaxy, on averages, and then say, well, how many galaxies do we think there are in a region of the universe? If we look out here with the best telescopes, how many galaxies do we think are in there? And then we're just going to extend that across the whole space and make an estimate for how many galaxies there could be. So astronomers estimate there are about 100 billion or 10 to the 11th power stars in a galaxy, and there are about 200 billion galaxies, 200 billion galaxies in the observable universe with what we can observe with our technology and instruments today. That's that many stars. It's an unbelievably big number, 10 to the 23rd. One time I figured out how long it would take to say all the names. If you could name a star every second, how long would it take to name 10 to the 23rd stars? Remember, God calls them all by their names. And it turned out that I did it in terms of the world population. So if you have 7 billion people all naming one star every second, it would take years and years and years to name all the stars. It's an incredible number. He telleth the stars. Did I go backwards here? Maybe I did by accident. So did I have this in twice? Maybe I did. That's strange. All right. In any case, in the book of Isaiah, God says, I have made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens and all their host I commanded. So God is at the helm. God is the commander of all of those stars, 10 to the 23rd power. I borrowed that sequence of distances, multiples of 10 and so forth from somebody. I forget where I got it. In any case, to give credit to it there. And I never actually mathematically checked it. I trusted the source on that. I believe it's accurate for our purposes. From Nathaniel Waldron, who was a former fellow teacher of mine at Terry Hill for several years, he had done a presentation where he talked about the uniqueness of this Earth. So scientists are desperate to try to find another Earth somewhere. They're looking for water. Like, they just can't wait to find water. And I think it's just, if they could just find water or just find something, then maybe their theory of evolution would have just a little bit more validity. And so they keep hoping and hoping. In any case, I don't know. I don't personally believe that there is another earth with any life on it. I think God made this earth. I think he sent his son Jesus to this earth to save his creation on this earth. It says that Jesus died once for all the people, I believe, that live here. But in any case, the earth is not just, you couldn't just have an earth. Let me just say it that way. You couldn't just have an earth. And so it's really rare to have a planet like this in the universe. And here are a few things that are just right about the Earth. So it's at the right location in the right kind of galaxy. So we've been able to figure out where in the Milky Way galaxy our solar system is located. So for an Earth to exist, it's in the right kind of galaxy, and it's at the right location in the galaxy. It's the right distance from the right kind of star. So it needs a sun, and it has to be the right distance from the sun. It's got the right order of the right planets in the solar system. We've got a solid planet, planet Earth, of just the right size. We've got the right magnetic field. And that actually has something to do with something I'll mention in a little bit here. We have the right kind of moon. And we have the right kind of atmosphere. All those things are just right. I don't know how many of you have actually personally had the opportunity to see the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. Raise your hand if you've had that opportunity. So there are a few of you. It's a really rare occasion to see them here in our latitudes. In Canada, we saw them a few times. And if you go north to the further north latitudes, you can see them much more frequently. In any case, I follow just a little bit of space weather because I'm interested in the Northern Lights and if we ever have the chance to see them here. And so I follow spaceweather.com, and there was a rather significant coronal mass ejection in the last 48 hours from the sun, which by chance, if you follow any of the sun's solar cycle, we're in the maximum time of sunspot activity, and coronal mass ejections are associated with sunspot activity. I think we're forecast to hit probably the maximum of the cycle next year. But as we approach that, sunspot activity and coronal mass ejections are forecast to increase. And so the potential for interference in GPS functionality and satellites and all that stuff is increasing over the next year because of the solar storms that are predicted to happen. Well, in any case, there was one within the last 24 hours, 24 to 48 hours, that is projected to reach Earth in the next 24 to 48 hours. And it's actually a pretty significant one. And so what I heard was that the chances of seeing the aurora are pretty good, even down to the middle latitudes where we live. So if you can get to a dark spot tomorrow night, even in spite of a full moon tomorrow night, there's a full moon, but it's going to be darkened some by a penumbral lunar eclipse tomorrow night. So they're saying those who want to take pictures of the northern lights may actually have the unique opportunity to take photos where you can see the northern lights well and have a full moon in the same picture, which is really rare. So that's tomorrow night. So here are some, I think tomorrow night, here are some pictures of the northern lights. And the charged particles that are put out from the sun during a coronal mass ejection is what come hurtling towards Earth at just phenomenal speeds. The sun, 27 million degrees Fahrenheit. Particles escape from the star from the sunspot regions. Hurtling particles of plasma, they're known as solar wind, they hurtle out into space. It takes them about 40 hours to reach the Earth. And the Earth is constantly bombarded with debris, radiation, and other magnetic waves from space that could threaten the future of life as we know it. I'm reading here. Most of the time, the planet's own magnetic field does an excellent job of deflecting these potentially harmful rays and particles, including those from the sun. So God has given the Earth's magnetic field to protect us here. It's just the right set up. If you ever look at photos that photographers take, it is just absolutely mind-boggling and just incredibly beautiful. And they're not just stationary lights, they're lights that move around the sky. In the mid-latitudes here, usually the best we get is just a faint glow, a light whitish glow, maybe just a little bit of color attached to it. But up in the northern latitudes, with every solar storm, they have opportunities to take these kind of pictures. This was a photo from 2017. So if you know a little bit about solar eclipses, there was a total solar eclipse in 2017, and that's a photographer's picture of it. And we have another one coming here in April, April the 8th. So if you have an opportunity, I hope you get outside to see it. I believe the coverage is supposed to be around 90%+ here. So it won't be completely hidden, as you can see right here, but it's going to be pretty close. Is anybody driving to be able to see the full eclipse? Oh, wow, about four or five or six people here. So, yes, just a couple chances in a lifetime maybe to see it. But what an awesome picture. Another thing I tell my students is that when we study geometry, which literally, again, means the study of the Earth or measurements of the Earth, we're just studying the things that we have seen. None of this are things that man came up with himself. They're just things that he has seen. So the circle is not man's idea. The circle is God's idea. And there are lots of other shapes and things that we study in geometry that were God's ideas. As you know, water is key to our lives and to life on Earth. And we said about how scientists would love to find, looking for evidence of water on other planets and so forth. But just let's park for a moment and think about the significance of water here and how God, again, has created the Earth just right. So 70% of our Earth's surface is covered with water. And if you were able to spread that water out over the entire surface of the Earth and make the surface level, it would be 1.7 miles deep over the entire Earth. So that's how much water we have. on the surface of the earth. 65% of our body is water. Isn't that incredible? So if you think of your from your head to your feet, okay, and come down, if this is 100%, and you come down until you reach 65%, so the rest of the way from here down is water. And of course, the water is spread out through our bodies, but that's how much water is in our bodies. Liquid water is a liquid in a relatively narrow temperature range compared to other substances. Water has a very high specific heat. That means it can take it takes a lot of energy to raise, and it takes you need to take a lot of energy away from liquid water to lower its temperature. So the oceans act as a huge insulating factor to our Earth. It's why we don't burn up in summer and why we don't freeze, because of the water that is here on Earth. It has high surface tension. It has a high latent heat of vaporization. That means it takes an extreme amount of heat to be able to get it to evaporate. It's known as the universal solvent. And so think about how many things you can dissolve in water, just H2O. It is less dense as a solid than it is as a liquid, which is why ice floats. Think about how different the world would be if things would freeze from the, if the ice would move to the bottom as it froze, instead of staying on top. That would change a lot. From the book of Job, "Behold, God is great, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable, for he draws up the drops of water." Do you read that? He draws up the drops of water. Somehow Job knew that the drops of water went up before they came down. Think about it. Have you ever seen a drop of water go up? "They distill his mist in rain," Job says. That's the clouds, which get heavy enough and then produce rain, "which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly." So Job had the idea of how God had already put into place the what we know as the water cycle, and the importance of that to the earth and to mankind. "All the rivers run into the sea," Solomon said. "Yet the sea doesn't get full." How does that work? Well, it's because the water's going up, right? "Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again." So Solomon had insight into the full water cycle here that we experience through the evaporation condensation process. So we have water as a liquid, we also have water as a solid, and I don't know if you've ever seen an individual ice crystal or snow crystal or water crystal, but a lot of things, when they crystallize, form geometric shapes by God's design. And so you have octahedrons and hexahedrons and various kinds of hedrons and in the minerals when they crystallize and so forth. Sometimes you can see those if you have rock specimens and so forth. In any case, individual water crystals, we know six-pointed stars, right? Or six-pointed snowflakes, right? Well, if you could find just one individual crystal. Snowflakes are usually composite snowflakes, so they're made of lots and lots and lots of little crystals that clump together in the atmosphere as they're coming down. So you're seeing a cluster of snowflakes in what we call snowflakes. And here are some photos of individual ice crystals. No man can take credit for this. The hexagon is God's idea. It's not the geometry teacher's idea. I think that one's my favorite. There we've got the kind of concentric hexagon lines, and then inside we have a six-pointed star yet. And these are God's creation, his fingerprints. He's like, I'm telling you who I am if you will just listen. Moving to the plant kingdom. We have trees around here, but you go to Florida and then you see real big trees. So the live oaks, maybe some of you have seen the live oaks, but just massive trees. We have an incredible spectrum of plant life, and we're only going to show you a few things here. But incredible live oak trees, just unbelievable in size. My wife always kind of makes fun of me whenever I took our camera on trips and on hikes and things. I was always finding these things along the trail to take pictures of, and she just thought they were the most boring things. And so I'm looking at the design in the leaves. Do you know how many different leaves there are out there? Just leaves. So here are a few leaves. The elephant ear. Maybe you have some elephant ears around your house. Some are green, some are colored. The variation in plant flowers and flower petals and blooms. We have 6-petaled designs. We have 5-petaled designs. And look how nicely that one fits right inside a regular hexagon. And so, again, this is a pentagon, sorry. This is God's idea here, not man's. I was walking at Longwood Gardens with our family a number of years ago, and we saw this trumpet lily. And like, okay, the blooms hang down. That's interesting. And a curious fellow that I am, I said, well, I wonder what they look like from underneath. Now, I don't know how many people walk under, put their head down, and look up at the flower, but that's what I did. And this is what I saw. It's not real obvious from that view, from that perspective, but almost a perfect hexagonal shape there with the points. And so one of the few pictures here that I could take some credit for in the presentation, the trumpet lily. We have flower blooms that make almost perfect circles, or water lilies. We have 4-pointed flowers. I don't have any threes, but I have a picture of one that I use in geometry where there's an equilateral triangle arrangement, and then inside is another 3-point turned 180 degrees away from it, 3 things in the middle of the flower. And it's just amazing to me, the design that God has given us, if we will just look. The next slide shows you a number of occurrences of the logarithmic or equiangular spiral that we see in God's creation. So here is one. That's the nautilus shell. And if you follow that around into the middle, it's what mathematicians would call an equiangular spiral or a logarithmic spiral. And it seems like this print is one of God's fingerprints in creation, because it shows up in all kinds of places. So you have the nautilus shell. You have plants that grow in spirals like that. You have another plant where you see the leaves coming out from the center, or the parts of the plant in a spiral shape. That might be an artichoke plant. I'm not sure about that. And then we have your ear, which is just about that same shape, the outer ear. And then we have that, which is actually inside your ear. So God has designed the ear to receive the sound waves, the compressions that are moving through the air. And they enter your outer ear, and they encounter your eardrum, and they make your eardrum vibrate. And that passes the vibration into your inner ear to a 3 tiny little bones set up that move. And those three bones pass the vibration to some fluid in your inner ear. And the vibration goes through the fluid, so it goes through a liquid, and that vibration is then picked up by the nerve endings of your auditory nerve. This cochlea is about half a centimeter across. Okay, think about a centimeter, and then take half of it. That's how big this spiral is. And there are 25,000 nerve endings in that cochlea that all go to the auditory nerve and then travel back to your brain. And it's those nerve endings that take all the signals and allow you to hear all of the variety in sound that you can hear. We could spend a whole night talking about any one of these topics. There are so many amazing things about sound. I get to teach physics occasionally, and we just get to barely touch the surface on the science of sound. But it's just absolutely incredible the way God has shown himself even in the world of sound. And we only get to hear it because of this tiny little thing in our inner ear called a cochlea that's in the shape of this spiral that God has given to us. Our own Milky Way galaxy is a spiral galaxy, so we see the same shape from the mighty, huge, millions and millions of miles across to the tiny half-centimeter cochlea in your inner ear. We see hurricanes or tropical cyclones that form this same spiral because of their rotation. And if you look at the head of a sunflower, the seeds are packed in there in a spiral arrangement. So if you have sunflowers at home this summer, make sure you take one and you look at it, and I'll tell you what to do with it in just a little bit. Pine cones exhibit this same spiral arrangement. So do pineapples, so do strawberries, so there are a number of things. I hear the artichoke I mentioned. In any case, that's what the seed pockets of the pine cone look like. And when they open up, it drops its seeds on the ground. And we might look at that and say, what was God thinking when he designed the pine cone that way? Why are they arranged in spirals? And I don't know if you can see it. There are spirals that go from the center out this way around to the right, but there are also spirals that go out from the center and go around to the left. And so they're arranged in two spirals. Every single seed pocket is in two spirals, one that's going this way and one that's going this way. And we can count how many spirals there are on this pine cone to go all the way around. And there are a different number of spirals when you count one way versus when you count the other way. There's a different number of them. But what we have found in observing pine cones is that the numbers are not just random numbers. It ends up being two numbers that come from a special number set that if anyone's studied math and geometry and interesting things, you've come across the Fibonacci numbers. And it turns out that 99.9% of pine cones have a number of spirals that are from the Fibonacci set of numbers, and two numbers that are right next to each other in the sequence. 5 and 8 is one pair, 8 and 13 is another pair, 13 and 21 is another pair, and so you can pick up any pine cone and count the spirals, and those are the numbers of spirals you will find on the pine cone. I think the smallest I've seen was a big, huge pine cone in Florida that, if I recall right, had 3 and 5 would be the next two down. Might have been 5 and 8. I don't know if you'll find that around here, but there was a massive pine cone, so it didn't have as many seed holes, but 5 and 8. And so it doesn't end there, but the Fibonacci numbers are connected to the golden ratio, what the Greeks called the divine ratio. And the divine ratio is connected with the equiangular spiral, the thing we were just looking at here. So this pine cone has the spiral and the Fibonacci numbers both there. And you might look at it and say, wow, that's really cool, smart pine cone, you know, what's it thinking? But it turns out that there is no way to pack more seeds on that pine cone of that size. It has absolutely the highest packing efficiency arrangement. There is no way to take that size pine cone and put more seeds onto it. It's the highest packing efficiency arrangement. It's not a smart pine tree, please, but an intelligent creator who wants his living things to survive. And that's why he created them that way. Children, hopefully you enjoy what we've seen so far. Here's a few more things I think you'll love. When our family was in Grenada, I should say my wife and I guess, maybe Austin was along. He was along one time. But one of the years we were down with the senior class from Terry Hill, we had the privilege of going out onto the shore one night and seeing the sea turtles that come in occasionally down there. And so this is a giant sea turtle. A giant sea turtle comes up onto the sandy shore to lay her eggs, 60, 80, 100 at a time. And I have a short video clip here of the actual live action of the sea turtle. And here's where we get to use the sound, Sylvan. So we'll see between my device and your controls back there. Mine's, I think, up again. So let's see what we got. I'm up against, unless... Okay, maybe we'll figure it out. But anyways, so the sea turtle uses its kind of flippers in the back to dig a hole that's literally 3 feet deep in the sand. It reaches down in there and scoops the sand out and flips the sand. And when it's deep enough, it lays its eggs. The eggs drop. The eggs are soft, and the eggs drop in there. And then it closes up the hole before it heads back out to sea. So you might be wondering why 60 to 100 eggs. Well, the chances for a giant sea turtle to live from its birth to adulthood are very, very slim. In fact, as I remember, the chances really are about one from a group of 60 to 100 that will survive to adulthood. So biologists are working hard to try to ensure the survival of the giant sea turtle. When we were in Grenada, the biologists were there. They were actually, the sea turtle sometimes digs its nest too close to the water. The water will wash the sand away and wash the eggs away and kill all of the little babies. And so biologists will collect the eggs. They literally catch them as they come out of the turtle. So the turtle goes into a trance, kind of a trance-like state. We got to see this firsthand. We touched the turtle. It literally had really no idea what was going on as it was laying its eggs. And the biologists literally caught the eggs as they fell out. And then they bury them further away from the ocean so that the ocean can't wash them away. After whatever length of time it is, this is what you see. Those giant sea turtles start about a couple of inches across after they hatch out of their eggs. They have to dig out of that sand all the way up to the top. Remember, they're buried down in this sand hole 3 feet deep, and they somehow climb all the way up through the sand and out onto the surface, and they make their way to the water. Of course, there are a lot of things that would just love to have a little sea turtle for breakfast, and that's why the chances of them surviving are only one. One in 60 to one in 100. But again, just an incredible picture of the handiwork and the design that God has given to us. A fish, a tropical fish, and we don't have any sound effects here, so just watch the motion here. So it shoots water from its mouth. And it has incredibly good aim. There's its target. And it has its meal. I'm actually forgetting the name of the fish right off the top of my head here. I don't have it down, but maybe somebody out there knows the name of it. But amazing to me. And one from the arachnid family. Anybody know what it is? So this is the trapdoor spider. It lives in a little hole in the ground with a little trapdoor over top that just is camouflaged completely in with the rest of the ground surface. There's a human finger opening up the trapdoor. So the spider lives down in there, made its home, builds a trapdoor on it. Okay, guess what? That little trapdoor shuts. That spider can tell when a prey is walking around right above its trapdoor, and then just like that, it bursts out of the trapdoor, grabs its prey, and pulls it back in for lunch. And I wish I had the sound here, so yeah. Just have to watch. He'll jump when you saw it just move there for a moment. And here's the actual picture. There's the prey. And there it went. That quick, grabbed that bug, pulled it back into its house. We are close to wrapping it up here. 1977, oceanographers, okay, 1977, think about how recent that is. I was 5, now you can figure out how old I am. Oceanographers sent a submersible vehicle to the deepest trenches, some of the deepest trenches of the ocean, named Alvin. The submersible was named Alvin. And for the first time, they discovered what have become known as hydrothermal vents in where the plates, the tectonic plates, come together on Earth's surface. And at these plate intersections or boundaries, the ocean water seeps down into the Earth's crust and comes into contact with the very hot magma. And so the water is heated up to 700 degrees, and minerals dissolve in the water and gases, and then it circulates back up to the surface. So there's this interchange of this really hot water, which doesn't boil, by the way, even though it's at 700 degrees because of the high pressure it's under. Down at the bottom, around 7,000 feet below the surface. So it's not in the very deepest trenches, but around 7,000 feet below the surface. And they discovered life forms down there that we had never seen before, hundreds of them. And these life forms don't depend on light at 7,000-8,000 feet below the surface. No sunlight reaches down there. But they are fully alive. And it turns out that there are bacteria living in these things that are called tube worms. And the bacteria in the tube worms can utilize the dissolved gases that are in the water, in this hot water. And then the bacteria and these other organisms form the bottom of a food chain in the ecosystem there for other living things that live down there. Things like we've never seen until we went there. So here are just a few creatures that God has created. I don't know when he put them down there. You know, we have our ideas about what the flood did to the surface of the earth and things. Evolutionists, I mean, they have to come up with some explanation for how these things get down there too. But that God put them down there at some point. And so we see fish-like things that we've never seen before. Lots of kind of shellfish type things, shrimp-like things, and just really weird things. That's the head of a worm that lives down in the region of the hydrothermal vent. God's got a sense of humor, too. Got to. From the mighty to the small, let's just take a couple minutes and then we're going to wrap it up here and go inside our own bodies to our living cells. So how big is a cell? So I did some looking. I came up with an average diameter, average distance across, of about 20 micrometers. A micrometer is 1/1000th of a millimeter. So if you know the metric system good enough, your metric rulers that have centimeters, and then the centimeter is divided down into millimeters, which are small. If you could somehow take that millimeter distance and make it into 1,000 distances, divide it evenly, that would be the average, times 20, that would be the average size of one of the human cells. All right, that's too small for you to see. You have to have powerful microscopes to be able to see them. The cell has its complete own entire world of things going on inside it, and we could just spend hours and hours. If you have advanced biology, Lisa, this year, I don't know how much you went into the inner workings of the cell, the organelles that are in there, the Golgi complex, and things of just absolutely incredible. The organization and the things that are happening that have to happen for us to live and for our cells to work. And it's happening in an environment that's so small you can't see it. And if the cell wasn't small enough, why 100 bacteria can fit into one cell? That is how small the bacteria are. And if it's any comfort to you, you've got about as many bacteria living inside you as you have cells, somewhere in the range of about 35 trillion. They used to say there's more bacteria than cells, but the most recent counts are saying they probably have about as many bacteria in us as cells. And it's amazing we don't get sicker more often than we do, all right, thanks to God's design. Here's just a really short computer-generated simulation of something happening in the cell. As best as we can depict what's happening in there, you won't get the talking with it if I have this hooked up right here. So this thing is a protein, that thing right in front there, carrying a huge thing along on a track, on a road, inside your cell. Remember, this is all microscopic, 1/1000th of a millimeter across. It's a complete another world in there, all its own. Disposal systems to get rid of the waste, protections to make sure intruders can't get in. That's why we don't get sick more often. Every now and then we do, right? Things break down because of our fallen world. From the mighty to the small, if I could just maybe wow you one more time. So cells about 1/10th the diameter of your hair, a piece of hair, 1/10th the diameter of a hair. And there's probably about 2 to 3 billion cells in your big toe. About 2 to 3 billion cells in your big toe. But inside every single one of your cell is this double helix of DNA where the instructions for who you are and what you look like, all of the directions for you are there. Deoxyribonucleic acid, did I say it right, Lisa? DNA and RNA. One single gram of this DNA is capable of holding 700 terabytes of data. The amount of information in 1 gram of your DNA is equivalent to 700 terabytes of storage. That's a lot even today yet for digital storage. If you were to type out the human genome, which is all of the genetic information in one human, in one cell, the human genome, if you could type it out, it would take 50 years to type it, typing at a speed of 60 words per minute for 8 hours a day. 60 words per minute, 8 hours a day for 50 years just to type out the amount of instructions that are in every single one of our cells. And remember, that's inside something that's 20,000th of a millimeter across. If you could take the human cell and all the DNA in it and stretch it end to end, it's the equivalent of, hang on here. Let me backtrack. So all that DNA inside your cell is the geometric equivalent of packing 24 miles of fine thread inside a tennis ball. So size and length, about 24 miles of fine thread inside a tennis ball. That's from NIH. If you could unwind all of the DNA that's in a human body and you could go end to end with that DNA, so take all the cells, 35 trillion something, and all of the DNA that's in there and put it end to end from one person, that length is enough to go 10 billion miles. Billion. That's the distance from here to the planet we call Jupiter and back. And back. Even every one that is called by my name, for I have created him for my glory, I have formed him, yea, I have made him. I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. The evolutionist and those who don't want to acknowledge the existence of our awesome creator worship the image, worship the creation. Let's let the glory that we see take our worship to the one who made it. Don't miss the glory. In the world that God has made, he's written his signature all over the place, and he's told us that in his creation, we will learn who he is. Let's pray. Father, we just take a moment to stand in awe of you. We can't even imagine what you have done, and yet you have made all this for us. You have made us in your likeness and in your image so that we could see if just a little bit of a glimpse of who you are, to understand that you have made us, that you've actually taken this dirt and you have formed us as your highest creation so that we would bring you glory. I pray that we would do that. Help us not to give glory to the things that it doesn't belong to, Father. It's so easy to do. And we pray that our reasoning, that our ability to think, and the things you've given to us that are like you would be used to find out more of you and to that it would call ourselves and that we would call others to worship you. Thank you for showing yourself to us. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.